So we are back in Ruth. I almost said the gospel according to Ruth, but that's not technically accurate, but there is some truth to that, I think. So one of the features of Ruth that we didn't really get into last week when we just looked at those first opening five verses is that there is a lot of dialogue in Ruth. That's actually kind of what keeps the story going, is all of these different conversations that take place between Naomi and Ruth, or Naomi and her daughters-in-law, or Ruth and Boaz, or Boaz and the townspeople. But for a short book, 85 verses, the majority of those are actually conversations, or what we would call perhaps speeches, which is kind of how we're going to look at the rest of chapter 1. Five speeches take place in chapter 1. There's four by Naomi, and there's one by Ruth. And I think this is really telling because it actually shows us a lot of what's going on, a lot of what was kind of behind the scenes in verses 1 through 5 is going to come out now as we understand what it is that has happened to Naomi, and as we understand Ruth's response to that and what it means for her. So we're basically going to encounter these speeches. I think if you were to follow them in order, Naomi would have three, Ruth would have one, and then at the end of the chapter, Naomi has one more speech. So this is going to help us to understand the characters. And of course, we know that Ruth is by far the most, well, her and Boaz are the virtuous characters in the story. Okay, we're going to see how that comes out in the dialogue and the responses that they have to one another. Naomi is a little bit more questionable. And it's interesting to read different commentators and to see their different perspectives and how they read Naomi. But she's not as, I think she's actually fairly clear, but people either see her in a positive light and people either see her in a more negative light. And you can see the reasons for that as we work through. One commentator I read just last night, at the end of the chapter, he's trying to explain how it is that Ruth, even though Naomi is going to try to persuade her not to come, how is it that Ruth decides to follow Naomi? And his explanation was, I think, a little beyond what the text actually describes. His explanation was that, well, Ruth, even though her words didn't necessarily communicate the truth that she was believing, they actually saw something in her character. They saw something in her actions while being in Moab that actually appealed to Ruth, and Ruth was so persuaded by the way that Naomi lived her life that she decided to pledge herself to her. Now, I don't think you necessarily see that in the text, but that's one way in which there's this desire to read Naomi in a positive light. And there's ways in which we try to explain why that is so. But I just want you to listen to the text, let the text speak for itself, and then we can try to understand what it is that Naomi is actually saying. So let's read now, starting in verse 6 through verse 22. But then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you in the house of her husband." And then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." And they lifted up their voices and wept again, And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you, for where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said to them, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So last week we saw initially that this first crisis faced by Elimelech and his family was that there was a famine in the land, that the land that God had promised would be flowing with milk and honey had dried up. There was no food. So the land of Moab appealed to Elimelech, and he decided to move his family to the country, to the land of Moab. So they moved out from the land of promise. They turned away from God's people and from God's place, and they went into exile. And that was not the end of the calamities that was faced by Elimelech and his family. We saw, at least initially, sometime soon after they arrived in Moab, Elimelech dies, and Naomi is devastated, and she decides to marry her sons off to the Moabite women. And they marry, and then sometime during the next 10 years, both her sons die as well. So she is devastated again, bereaved, and now has absolutely nothing. Just her two daughters-in-law. No protection, no provision. She is destitute, living in exile in a foreign land. That is where the introduction ends. And now we get to see how the story continues. So in our passage today, verses 6 and 7 actually show us how the Lord had ended that initial crisis. The famine in the land is now over. God had visited his people and given them food. Now what this does is it actually keeps the story going. So it's not just a story about an Israelite family, a Bethlehemite family living in the country of Moab and facing devastation. There's actually more to it than just that. How is it that they get out of the land of Moab? How is it that they return to the land of promise? How is it that these people, their name continues? Which we know is kind of the whole point of the book, is to show us exactly how Elimelech and his line and his name and his people continue on. Quite unexpected ways. But first of all, let's look at the way in which the author describes this. And it is a little bit clunky. It's a little bit repetitive. But it's important for us because it actually highlights some important themes in the passage. So notice how he describes this return. So beginning in verse 7, she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab. She set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. So basically in three different ways, three different times, the narrator is telling us that they are now en route to the land of Judah. They're going back to Bethlehem. It's interesting, if you look back at the end of the chapter, in verse 22, you see something very similar. Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab. So do you see the theme? Do you see what the author is repeating over and over again? In fact, he actually repeats it 12 times in these, 15, 16 verses. This is about the return. This is about the return of the woman, the return of Naomi to the land. The return of what she liked to call herself, bitter, at the end of the chapter. So it's a word that's used in verse 6, and verse 7, and verse 8, and verse 10, 11, 12, 15, 16, 21, and 22, for a total of 12 times. Interestingly, it's only used 3 other times in the book. It's not used to describe their exile in 1 through 5. So you can understand the point that they're trying to make. This is how Barry Webb summarized it. He says, in verse 6, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return. In verse 7, they set out to return. In verses 8 through 10, Naomi tells the two girls to go return to their mother's home, but they decline and insist on returning with Naomi. In verses 12 through 15, she urges them again, return, go. And when Orpah does so, Naomi encourages Ruth to return after her. But in verse 16, Ruth begs Naomi not to make her return. And in the last verse of the chapter, Naomi and Ruth are found united in returning. Naomi returns with Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, literally the one who returned. So it becomes very clear when we just notice the way in which the author is using that word, returning. And that actually helps us to understand a little bit of Naomi's appeal. She is not telling her daughters-in-law to return with her to the land of Judah, even though that's where she will end up and that's where Ruth will end up. She wants them to return or to turn back to the land of Moab. So it's this interesting interplay between understanding the dynamics between Naomi's appeal and the daughters-in-law's response and what ends up happening. The word turn or return is actually just a word that's used even in the prophets to describe repentance. It's literally a turning. It's a turning away from something or a turning to something, depending on how it's framed. So in one way, we can understand that this is a chapter about Naomi's repentance, her turning back to the land of Judah, her turning back to Yahweh, turning back to the God of the covenant, turning back to her people. But that doesn't quite, I think, get at the heart of what's really taking place in Naomi. It is, in one sense, a repentance. But as we look at it and try to understand it through her own words, we see that it is, in one way, almost not a false repentance, but it's an incomplete repentance. She's turning back, but what she expects to happen in Judah is not good. Even though she's going back to Bethlehem, to the house of bread, and lo and behold, there's actually bread now in Bethlehem. She's going back, but it doesn't seem like that's going to be a good thing for her. And she doesn't communicate that that's going to be a good thing for her daughters-in-law. That's why she tries so hard to persuade them not to come with her. They are better off in Moab, which is very telling. They're better off in exile. So let's look at this now. Let's look at why she would want to go back to Bethlehem. Now, it doesn't appear to be any plans on moving back to Bethlehem. It wasn't like they were just vacationing in Moab. Remember how the author describes that. They go to the land of Moab. They are content to be sojourners in that land. They, in fact, remain there. And even after Elimelech died, they lived there for 10 years. And Mahlon and Chilion died. So there must have been some way for them to support themselves. Even when she hears about what the Lord has done in Bethlehem, she's in the field. So it's as if she's farming or gathering food for herself in the land of Moab. Every indication seems to be that they were content to live in exile, to live out their days away from God's people, away from God's place, away from God's covenantal presence. So Naomi is at this point. And then that one day while she's in the field working, she hears some Moabites talking about all the food in the land of Judah. And she concludes from this, I mean, it's not necessarily her conclusion, it's what the narrator tells us, that the Lord had visited his people. The Lord had visited his people and given them food, literally given them bread. There is now bread in the house of bread. Now, this is the solution to the crisis that was originally introduced in verse 1. There was a famine in the land. That's why Elimelech decides to leave the land of Judah. But now, the Lord has taken notice of his people. And he has acted accordingly. And he has, in fact, brought them food. It doesn't explain how that happened. Whether it was providing rain, providing seed, providing something. But now there is food in the land. No longer dried up. It is now a land that's flowing with milk and honey, a land flowing with waves of barley, waves of grain blowing in the wind. Whatever it might be, God has responded to his people. Now, interestingly, when you consider the visit, a visit from Yahweh, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Just taking the concept in general. So if your boss comes into your office and says, hey, I really need to talk to you about your performance, this could mean one of two things. It could mean that you're getting a pink slip, or it could mean that you're getting a promotion. If a doctor comes and visits you, he could tell you that you're on the mend or that there's nothing he can do and that you need to get your house in order. And that's what we see happening when we hear of the Lord visiting his people. Visiting his people can mean that God is coming now to act on their behalf. He is coming now to bring blessing, to fulfill his promises. He's coming now to deliver them. The same word is used to describe God fulfilling his promise to Sarah that she would bear a son. He comes and delivers her in her anguish and her barrenness. The promise that he gave her that she would bear a son, the Lord visited Sarah and did as he promised. Genesis 21:1. Joseph promised his brothers that God will visit you in this land of exile, in Egypt. God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the promised land. Genesis 50:24-25. And we're actually told in the early chapters of Exodus that this is exactly what happened. The Lord tells Moses, tell the people of Israel that I am going to visit them. I've heard their cries of anguish. I've seen their afflictions. And I am going to visit them. I'm now noticing what's taking place in them, and I'm going to act accordingly. And when they heard those words that God is visiting them in Egypt, Exodus 4:31, he had seen their affliction, their 400 years of slavery, and they bowed their heads and worshipped. But of course, this word is actually used also in a negative sense, that God does not just act on behalf of his people to bring about blessing. He acts on behalf of his covenant, on behalf of his people to bring about punishment. In fact, that's how the word is actually translated in the ESV a lot of the times in the prophets. Sometimes when the Lord visits, he brings affliction upon his people. He afflicts them with panic or wasting disease and fever. Sometimes he visits the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation. In Hosea, he says this, I will visit her for the feast days of the Baals. I will punish her for her idolatry. I will visit them for their ways and repay them for their deeds. So this is God acting on behalf of his covenant, the covenant that he made with the people of Israel. And we know that this is the case because of the famine in the land in the first place. That was a promise that God had given to the people. If they forsake him and his ways, and they worship other gods, and they break his commandments, that he would afflict them with famine. So the presence of the famine does not mean that God is somehow absent or withdrawn from his people. He's actually there. He's actually there bringing about the reality that they are facing. He's bringing about the reality of the curse, the drought, the curse upon the land. So what does it mean then that God visits his people and brings them food? Well, it means a couple different things. It means that there had been people who remained in Bethlehem. In fact, you see this. They go back to Bethlehem, and who do they encounter? Well, they encounter all the people who lived in the town. And who does Ruth encounter the next day? They encounter Boaz. Well, what did Boaz do during the period of famine? Did he leave? Did he move out? Did he go south, or did he go north, or did he go to some other place? No, the impression that we get is that they actually remained in the land, and the assumption that we can make based upon God's covenantal work is that they had turned from their idolatry, whatever that would have been. That they had turned, and now God had relented from bringing the curse down upon them, and instead had brought blessing. He had provided food for them, provided bread. Now, I don't want to read too much into the text. I think that's safe for us to land there, even though that's not what the narrator is saying. But we know that is a part of the covenant. Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. Anyways, Naomi hears that the Lord is on the move, that the Lord is doing something. And the Lord is providing his people with food. So she takes the opportunity now to decide she's going to go back to Bethlehem. She's going to move back home. Now is the time. So interesting here, I think there's something, you know, even probably more profound going on, is that we can actually see in this text, I think, the location, the sphere in which God is working. Now, was Naomi drawn to that? I'm not entirely sure. But at least she knows that there's food back in Bethlehem. There's possibly support for her. But that is where God is at work. God is at work with his people, in his place, carrying out his purposes and his promises. His promise to curse, promise to bless. And that's possibly what draws her back. So she decides to go. Now, what she's going to do here is she's going to attempt to convince her daughters-in-law not to go with her. I think there's three different appeals that she makes. It's kind of this religious appeal to her. There is kind of a logical appeal, hypothetical appeal perhaps. And then there's the appeal to the example of Orpah. So let's look at these three speeches quickly with Naomi. First of all, this religious approach. Now she tries to convince her daughters-in-law that they can find the Lord's covenantal kindness and the rest that the Lord provides in the land of Moab. So go back to the house of your mothers. Stay in Moab. This is where the Lord is going to show you covenantal kindness. And this is where you're going to have rest. This is where you're going to have consolation. So the first speech, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you." That's the word, hesed. "As you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." So this is her appeal. This is her theology at work, right? This is what's really coming out of her fingertips. This is what she really believes. And I think it's completely backwards to what we should expect in faithful Israelite to see. Now, she is giving this benediction, this blessing to her daughters-in-law, saying, this is where you're going to find God's, Yahweh's, faithfulness, His covenantal kindness, His steadfast love. This is where you're going to experience that by staying in Moab. Whether that be in your mother's house, back with your family, or whether that be through another husband that you happen to find, another man that you possibly marry. That's how God's going to provide for you. He's going to do so when you stay in the land. Now, on the one hand, it doesn't seem like it's that bad of a blessing, right? Don't you want God's covenantal kindness to be upon the strangers and the sojourners and even the Gentiles? I think, yes. But we understand the sphere of God's work and where He is now at work and where His covenantal people are located. We would think that her response would be the exact opposite of this. But this actually shows us what she understands about God. She doesn't expect anything good in going back to the land of Judah. So, therefore, she doesn't want her daughters-in-law to go with her. There's no hope for them there. Yet, her blessing, it sounds religious, it sounds spiritual, it sounds orthodox. It seems as if she has their best interests at heart. We really want you to experience God's covenantal kindness. We really want you to have rest. I want the best for you. Yet, this is not Naomi's own experience. Has she actually experienced God's covenantal kindness? And I think her answer would be no. She's experienced, and she understands her experiences as being God's curses, God's affliction, the calamities that God has brought upon her. So she wants something, what we would say would be good for her daughters-in-law, but it's not necessarily what she has experienced. It's not how she understands God to be working with her. So she tries to persuade them to stay in the land of Moab. Now, a second appeal here, of course, after that speech, there's a lot of crying and raising of voices and kissing. But we'll just skip over that part. So there's a second speech, a second appeal. The girls are, just to give you a context here, most people kind of speculate that Naomi is probably about 40 and Ruth and Orpah are around 25. So considering that they had been married for 10 years, maybe they married at 14 or 15. So they're in their 20s and she's probably about 40 or so. So she's not really old, right? So you would think that she would still be eligible for another marriage, but she doesn't see herself that way. So the second appeal now, this is kind of the appeal to logic. She tells them, just to think about it for a second. If you're going to follow me to the land of Judah, let me just explain to you what's going to happen. She has no more sons to give them in marriage. She's too old to have a husband for herself. And hypothetically, even if she did happen to find a husband and have sons, it's not as if Orpah and Ruth would wait for them to grow up so that they could marry them. Right? That just doesn't make any sense. Well, she were to remarry and conceive and have a child, and that child would get to an eligible age to marry. You're talking, 15, 16 years down the road. It's not as if their 15 or 16-year-old son would then redeem through levirate marriage Orpah or Ruth when they're in their late 30s. So that is, in essence, what she's saying now through the second appeal. Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? So Naomi has no hope like anything like this could happen. And it's hard for her to swallow. She is distressed by it. And even when we get to the end of verse 13, this is her words. It is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. This is her misery being expressed. Her grief being expressed. It's exceedingly bitter to me. And she seems, again, to be focusing not on her own situation, but upon her daughters-in-law, which is good. But the words that she uses to describe what has happened to her should cause her to pause and to think about what's actually going on. The hand of the Lord has gone out against me. God is opposed to me. Right? God is not visiting me in that sense in which he is acting for my benefit. God is simply against me. And therefore, if you accompany me back to Judah, that's what you can expect. There's not going to be anything good for you. You know, this has been so difficult and challenging for me, and you know, I wouldn't want that for you, so I want you to stay here, because if you go with me back to Judah, then you're going to be afflicted as well. I'm cursed. So I think that's how we should actually read it. The Lord is against Naomi. And in a way, says my sons, my house, my seed has died off. The Lord is against anyone who's attached to me in that way. Interestingly, we read last week in Judges chapter 2, that's the word that's used, actually, the hand of the Lord. That's the word that's used when God acts against his people. In Judges 2:15, he acts against Israel. The hand of the Lord acts against them, is opposed to them. So in one way, Naomi is almost kind of representative of Israel. At least in her own expression, she's representative of Israel in the book of Ruth. The hand of the Lord is against me. And she doesn't expect that anything can change that situation. So she sees things through her narrow lens. This is what's going to happen. I don't have any more kids. No one's going to marry me. And even if I did get married and had kids, you're going to be too old and they're going to be too young and these things wouldn't work out. But she is at least somewhat more successful than the first appeal. She goes 1 for 2. So they wail and weep again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. So she persuades, Orpah may have had some hope, possibly, may have had hope that things would be better for her in the land of Judah. Now, I don't know why she would think that. I mean, she is a Moabitess. She is a part of the people that are opposed to Israel. She is a part of the people that are enemies of Israel. And life for her would not necessarily be easier in the land of Judah, just as it wasn't easier for Naomi when she moved to Moab. It's not all that it's cracked up to be, right? So Orpah does what Orpahs do. She turns her back on Naomi and goes back to the land of Moab. But Ruth clings to her, cleaves to her. That's the same word used in Genesis 22, or Genesis 2. Talk about marriage, the clinging, the holding fast, the cleaving with one another. This is Ruth's desire, her heart being expressed by holding fast, not listening to the appeals of Naomi, because she is fully committed to Naomi. So let's look at the third appeal. Now she's going to use Orpah as an example. So the religious appeal, you know, the Lord be merciful to you, be kind to you in the land of exile. The logical appeal, you know, this is not going to happen. Things are not going to work out. Just think about it. And now the appeal to example. She said to her, "See, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people." and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. Interesting. Probably a powerful example, considering that Orpah was a peer of Ruth's. We don't know about the dynamic between them. But listen to Naomi's words. She's gone back to her people and to her gods. She almost seems to be content that Orpah is going to go back into idolatry, which would seems very strange coming from the lips of a faithful Orthodox Israelite. You're going to stay in Moab and you're going to worship Chemosh or whatever their god's name was. I mean, they basically viewed their gods as being jurisdictional. So they had a particular influence over a particular area. And that's what makes Yahweh's claim to stand out all the more in that pagan society, is that his claim is that he is the God of all nations. He is the God of the entire world. He is the God of all creation. He's not just the God that you can put in one specific place, even though that's where he manifests his presence for the people of Israel for quite some time. But she's basically looking at Orpah and saying, this is what you ought to do, Naomi. These are your people. You're a Moabite. I mean, you can't hide that fact. It's really significant when you see, I think it's used six times, when Ruth is actually described as Ruth the Moabite. And she's saying, yes, go back. These are your people. I'm an Israelite. You're a Moabite. Just go back and stay with them. Go back and worship your gods. Return after your sister-in-law. So this is the example that Naomi wants Ruth to follow. Why? Because she really doesn't think that anything good is going to happen to her in the land of Judah. It's not going to be good for her. It hasn't been good for Naomi. It's not going to be good for you. So stop clinging to me. This is not where you'll find mercy and rest. This is not how you'll find a husband. This is where you'll only experience bitterness, because the hand of the Lord is against us. So turn back to your people and to your gods. You'll have much better luck with them. So Naomi is quite possibly the worst evangelist of all time. She does everything she can to convince Orpah and Ruth not to accompany her back to the land of Judah. Every appeal she can think of. She succeeds with back of the head, but not with Ruth. Now, none of this makes sense. I think Naomi is a grieving woman who hasn't fully repented, who is confused because of the affliction that she's experienced, and because of the lack of understanding how God is actually at work. If she would but open up her eyes and see why God is doing what he is doing, and trust the faithfulness and the goodness and the kindness of God for her, in which she would understand what's taking place. But she can't see it. We'll point that out as we continue. Now, what's going to happen is that Ruth is going to actually have a speech of her own in which she pledges her loyalty to Naomi. Probably the most well-known part of the book of Ruth. Maybe even the only words that we hear solely from Ruth in the book that bears her name. Ruth says, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." Now think about this. She's going to describe the way in which she pledges her loyalty to Naomi in three different ways. She commits to Naomi herself. She commits to Naomi's people. She commits to Naomi's God. And she follows that up with the consequence if she fails in keeping those commitments. Death. May Yahweh do so to me if I break my pledge to you. Just think about this for a moment. This is the, even though the word's not being used here, this is the loving kindness that God is actually, that Naomi is wanting God to extend, or at least she says that she wants God to extend it to Orpah and Ruth. But this is Ruth's embodiment of that very loving kindness, of that very covenantal faithfulness. How is it being displayed? It's being displayed by pledging her loyalty, committing herself to another person. Exactly what God does to his people, and exactly how God's people respond to him. God picks his people up, not the most impressive nation, not the largest nation, not the smartest nation, and he rescues them and he pledges himself to them. I will be your God and you will be my people. And the people say, yes, Lord, yes, we will do whatever you want from us. We will obey all of your commandments and we will pledge ourselves to you. You are our God, not the God of the nations. You are our God. You are the one who has rescued us. So it's interesting that Naomi, in even telling Orpah and Ruth about God's loving kindness, she has already described that they have exemplified that kindness back in verse 8. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. This is something that's already been on display. They've already showed kindness, and probably that's this commitment to the family even after the death of Mahlon and Chilion. They're still with her in the fields. They're still at least maybe attempting to follow her back to Judah. They've already showed her some sort of commitment and steadfast love and faithfulness. But now, Ruth actually puts it in words. Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. I'm going to be with you, Naomi, until I die. So do not tell me to go back to Moab. And her people are now going to be her people. Orpah went back to her people. And Naomi wanted Ruth to go back to her people too. And Ruth said, that's not my people. Your people are now my people. Now I am identifying myself with your people, with the people of Israel, the enemies of my people. She's saying, in essence, consider me now to be an Israelite. And she commits to Naomi's God. Your God is going to be my God. I'm not going to go back and worship the idols that I saw in my land, the impotent, small idols. I'm going to worship your God. I'm going to worship Yahweh. He is my God. So all of this, this complete expression of Ruth's commitment to be a covenantal partner with Naomi, show her steadfast love. It's a hard word to translate. Steadfast love or faithfulness or covenantal kindness, loving kindness, all those different ways express the idea at the heart of Chesed. The very words that God uses to express his relationship with his people. And now, all of that is being put on display by someone from the land of Moab. Not from the Israelite, not from Naomi, but from Ruth. And again, that's telling. So Ruth's final speech, finally silences Naomi. So we're done trying to hear Naomi convince Ruth not to follow her. Ruth saw that she was determined. Yeah, I'm not going to change her mind. And she said no more. Interesting here, what is absent in, you know, we don't know exactly everything that took place in the conversation, but there are no words here of gratitude, no words of being astounded at Ruth's commitments. She just doesn't say anything. So they decide to go. They go on their way. They arrive in Bethlehem, and it gives us an opportunity to look at one more speech. The town hummed with their arrival. They questioned her identity when they saw her appearance. Is this Naomi? Can this be Naomi? You know, all these people had stayed in the land while Naomi and Elimelech left. And it's been 10 years. 10 very hard and trying years for Naomi. And they see this woman come back with another woman. And they're wondering, you know, could that possibly be Naomi? And we're not talking about a large town. And you kind of get the idea that these 10 years have not been kind to her. The impression that you get is this, probably her figure has actually changed. Her appearance, maybe her countenance. There's a resemblance to how she looked before, but now you're just wondering, you know, it seems like living in exile is hard. You know, you probably encounter somebody after 10 or 20 years and you wonder, man, have they been doing drugs in the last 10 or 20 years? Or... No, you could tell. So everybody cancels their vacations in Moab and said, well, we're not going to go there. But the response of the people of the town is telling. She no longer wants to be known as Naomi, which is the word for pleasant or sweet. She wants a name change. She's coming back a new person. And she's going to take the initiative and change her own name. Create her own identity. Don't consider me to be sweet or pleasant anymore. You can call me bitter. She left Bethlehem 10 long years ago. She left full, satiated, satisfied. And now she has been brought back empty. And finally, the Lord is the one that's done it all. The Almighty dealt very bitterly with me. The Lord brought me back empty. The Almighty brought calamity upon me. We add this, verse 13, the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. All of these things wrapping up for us our understanding of this person who has been dramatically changed by her circumstances and through it all has revealed to us her character and her heart. So listen to her words. Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? So I ask you, what do you hear in her words? Is she blaming God for all that she's had to endure? Is she accusing him of wronging her in some way? Now, obviously, she's lost a great deal. And it's grievous, and she's distressed by it. That's completely understandable. But how does it come across? Does it come across as if her concern is only for herself, and God is just out there to get her, to punish her, to afflict her? And she doesn't shy away like we typically do. She doesn't shy away from actually crediting God for this stuff. This is what, she said it four times, this is what the Lord has done. The hand of the Lord is against me. He's brought me back here empty. He has brought this calamity upon me. He has testified. He's a witness against me. I hear a little bit of accusation, of self-pity. You have to question the truthfulness of her words. Did she really leave Bethlehem full? She left in the time of famine. They left probably because they didn't have anything. Did she really leave full, as she says? Is that her understanding of her own situation? We were full when we were here, and then we left, and now we've been brought back empty. Now we don't have anything. And of course, if you understand her fullness as a reference to her husband and to her son, then yes, you could say that they had fullness. But of course, it wasn't an exhaustive fullness. And you can understand perhaps that in that culture and at that time, that it probably wasn't her decision to leave the land of Judah, to leave Bethlehem. It probably was Elimelech's. He's the one that seems to have suffered for that decision, for leading his family into exile. So, one other thing here is the idea that she came back empty. Now, if her emptiness is a reference to the fact that she doesn't have a husband or sons anymore, then we can understand that reference. But she fails to actually explain or even to acknowledge the fact that someone has come back with her. Someone who has just pledged their whole entire life to her. Someone who has given themselves to her out of covenantal faithfulness. Even calling down a curse upon her if she breaks that commitment. What about Ruth? Are you not aware of this person that's just followed you back? A Moabite following you back? Claiming to be with you forever, lodging with you, living with you, giving herself to you and her and your people and your God? What about Ruth? So, Ruth is the one who has pledged herself to her for the rest of her life, left everything she's known behind, her people and her gods, and followed Naomi into a foreign land as a stranger into a potentially hostile people. And Naomi doesn't seem to be aware of that fact. At least she doesn't seem to acknowledge it. So what do we take away from this? I think what we should see this, obviously, this attribute of covenantal faithfulness exemplified in Ruth, understanding that they are intentionally using a foreigner, a Gentile, to show this, to teach the people of Israel. This was supposed to be what God's people embody themselves. This is the attribute, the characteristic of God Himself. Therefore, if we're going to be like Him, to be holy like Him, to grow into His image, to mirror Him and reflect Him across the earth and in the land, then shouldn't we also exemplify this chief characteristic of God? He is the faithful God who keeps covenant. And yet, His people, time and time again, were the people who broke covenants, especially during the time of the judges, a very dark time. But yet, in the person of Ruth, we see how this should be embodied and demonstrated among God's people. Now, I think Naomi's portrayal here for a second takeaway, her understanding of repentance, if that was kind of the intention to show us that Naomi is now coming back to the land, and all the while she's doing so, she's persuading those not to come back with her, it shows us that she is not yet quite to the point where she's fully turned. She's not fully understanding that yet God is just not out there to get her and to afflict her. His intentions in bringing these things upon her and her family is so that she would turn. So she fails to understand and interpret the providence of God. Why does God carry out these things that we would deem to be burdensome, troublesome, that we would deem to be grievous and cause us distress? It is out of His covenantal faithfulness that He does so. Not because He gets any pleasure in carrying out these things upon His people, but He loves His people and He wants them to turn back to Him. There is no rest, no comfort, no consolation outside of the boundaries and the borders that God has established. You don't go into exile looking for these things. You stay and you seek the Lord. Now, it also demonstrates for us, I think, where God is at work during this period of time in history? Where can we expect God's blessings? Now, of course, the book of Ruth is about an unexpected blessing. So it's not as if you can kind of make it into a formula or kind of create a paradigm. You know, you can make it mechanical so that just you do certain things, you follow certain steps and keep certain rules, and then God's blessing automatically happens. It's not like that. Blessing come from very unexpected places, like Moab. And the book of Ruth is about people not knowing exactly what God was going to do. Now, we can reread it, and we can see how God was actually at work. We can see how God, his purpose in visiting his people and relieving them of the famine and bringing bread, is actually going to draw Naomi back from the land of Moab. And she just so happens to come at the time of the barley harvest, which is going to propel the story forward. But Naomi's interpretation of it is that this is just a punishment that God is exacting upon his people. It's burdensome. No one likes it. God, you know, you're the one that's probably at fault for it to some extent. And yet, this is God's way to bring about blessing. Now, of course, if we take this and expand this out, then we can actually kind of, I think, illuminate where God's blessings are now. The temptation for us is to find God's blessings in what the world provides, what the world has to offer, because it's just so enticing. It just looks so good. This is the good life. You get married late, you don't have kids, you have good jobs, and you take lots of vacations. You know, it is the exact opposite in some ways of what's taking place in Ruth, where blessing and fullness is all wrapped up into marrying and having kids. When we see what God's plan and how it has actually developed and how it progresses, when we see how it culminates in Christ, we need to understand that there is no blessing for God's people outside of Christ. That is the sphere, that is the location where God's blessings come to fruition. And if we are tempted to depart from him and to look for something else, some other sort of blessing, if we hope to experience God's covenantal kindness and faithfulness outside of Christ, then we know that's not going to happen. There is only one place for God's people to find God's blessings. It's in his Son. Again, like I said, we should see in this too just how God moves even beyond the understanding of the characters in the story. They're back in the land of promise. They're back in the land of Judah, the place where God has visited his people. He has considered their condition, and he has taken action and provided them with bread. Something essential, but very, very simple. And he's now going to use that to draw Naomi and Ruth back so that he can continue to work in these chance occurrences in the small family in the town of Bethlehem to bring about offspring, children, a son, a king, who would deliver his people. So keep that in mind as we prepare our hearts for the Lord's Supper and for next week. Let's pray.